KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is now 7 p.m., and up next is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
KPFA Studios in Berkeley, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan, and with me here is Khalil Bendi.
Good evening, Malihe, and good evening to all of our listeners. In tonight's program, we'll be speaking with Bay Area labor activist Monadel Herzallah about the June 20th picket line at the Port of Oakland, which prevented Israeli Zimline ships from unloading their cargo, as well as with Eric Helgeson, spokesperson for the Swedish Dock Workers Union, which just ended a historic one-week-long boycott of all cargo to and from Israel to protest against the raid on the Gaza-bound aid flotilla that killed 9 people last month. Later in the program, we'll bring you a conversation with Arash Sobhani, lead singer and songwriter of Kiosk, a popular Iranian band that will be performing at Yoshi's in San Francisco this coming Sunday. Stay with us. And the latest series of activities around the world, with Palestinian calls for solidarity following the Israeli massacre on the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. On Sunday, June 20th, dock workers of the storied ILWU Local 10 at the Port of Oakland refused to unload an Israeli ship. I spoke earlier to Monadel Herzallah, longtime union organizer in the Bay Area and a coordinating committee member of the U.S.-Palestinian Community Network, which took an active role in organizing the protest at the Port of Oakland. Monadel, first I'd like to congratulate you and the ILWU on a spectacular and I think historic action, solidarity action with Palestine last week. Tell us briefly what happened and how it came to be.
Well, actually, when a criminal act was conducted by the Israelis, Freedom Flotilla, Gaza, we had some actions, and there was a lot of people who were responded immediately, as this has been an act of cowardice and an act of desperation for the Israelis to attack unarmed civilians going to deliver humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. Our relationship has been extremely good with our brothers and sisters in the labor movement, and not only in the Bay Area, but also around the world. So there was a call by the General Trade Union of Palestine to join the rest of the world in isolating and exposing the Israeli atrocities, and call for workers around the world to make business not as usual for the Israeli ships and to stop loading and unloading ships in the port. So we did have a response to the call. We called for organizing meeting. We had an overwhelmingly support, had a meeting on Wednesday, over 112 people, representation of the different unions, different community organizing. It was on the eve where the San Francisco Labor Council has passed a resolution asking for to conduct an international investigation and also ask for to break the siege on Gaza, same as Alameda Labor Council. So has really provided the correct environment for all union members and trade unionists in the Bay Area to do something significant that has never been done before on the issue of Palestine.
Yes, it's been 62 years now since the Nakba, and the labor movement in this country is not known for being pro-Palestinian. Far from it. It has overwhelmingly and wholeheartedly and unconditionally supported Israel for all these years and continues to do so. So how did it come to pass that, is this just the Bay Area? Is this a special niche in the United States?
I'm glad you're mentioned that, Khalil, but we do have Palestinian workers and Palestinian people in Gaza and elsewhere in the camps and inside Palestine, inside 1948. Have a faith in the workers and in the members, not necessarily of the union leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, this is historic because union members back in 1936, they have refused to load and unload ships from Nazi Germany. In 1938, they refused to unload and unload ships from fascist Italy. And the same in 1984, when they refused to unload and load ships from South Africa. So we do have a faith in the union members. We do have a faith in rank and file members who really stood up together and said, this is enough, and this way is not only exposing the Israeli aggression against workers and against people, but also exposing the relationship that you mentioned earlier with having a support to the segregation union of the Histadrut in Israel that is treating Palestinians like second-class citizens, and they collect dues from those members, and they don't provide any type of representation for them.
How does the rank and file manage to put enough pressure on the leadership to get results like this? Because I'm assuming at least some of the leadership is still reticent, still reluctant to go against Israel. Am I correct?
Yes, but basically what happened is we formed a community labor committee that consists of 20 different representation of labor and community that we decided to call for a mass picket line to block the gates, block the entrances of where the Zim line Israeli ships do their business, but the union members that are supposed to work, they honored the picket line, and we were really, really pleased and honored that union members did not cross the picket line. And not even one union member crossed the picket line. We're very proud of our sisters and brothers, union members who were there. There was over 800 people there at 5:30 in the morning on Sunday, June 20th.
Supporters.
That is historical, right.
And how long was the action? For how long were you able to delay?
Our goal was to make sure that the Israeli ship will be blocked for 24 hours. So we had an action at 5:30 in the morning. The arbitrator came. He had to make a decision whether it is safe for the workers to cross the picket line or not. So he decided that is not safe to do that. We were able to block it for the 12 hours. And then at 4:30, where the second shift had to come, the employer decided to cancel that shift. And the goal to block that ship for 24 hours was achieved, and people celebrated victory, and it made the news all over the port and the workers around the world in Sweden, in Norway, and elsewhere started to organize and talk about doing similar actions for that.
I hear also in Malaysia and South Africa and different countries things are happening also among the dock workers. How many workers were involved in this strike and this picket? Were wages lost during this 24 hours?
Well, luckily, the loss for the workers was very minimal for the fact that they were ready to work. There is a clause in the contract that talk about that is unsafe for workers to cross the picket line. It wasn't workers' fault. So the employer would have to pay for that day. The people who came at the afternoon, the employer's decision was to cancel that shift, which is a loss for that shift in the afternoon, but they could make it up for the next day because work has not been done. So there will be plenty of work for people as well. We're very curious about that. We're extremely important that members do not lose income. But that by itself is really amazing work, an amazing action of courage that Palestinians have sent immediately a letter to respected sisters and brothers. If you don't mind, I can read a small part of it.
Please.
That Manuel Abdelal, an executive community member, said, "We look to you today from Gaza Strip and all of Palestine and call upon you to repeat that courageous stand today. This genuine solidarity is something we have longed for and expected, as you are responding to our appeal. We expected from you nothing less because of your history of defending the oppressed, including our people suffering under Israeli occupation. You stand in opposition to the attack on the unarmed Gaza Freedom Flotilla, seeking to deliver humanitarian assistance to the besieged Palestinian people in Gaza. Your action today is a milestone in international solidarity from honest and brave U.S. workers and trade unionists. Greeting to you from the trade unionists and workers of Palestine, from the trade unionists and workers trapped in Gaza, seeking freedom from the entire world who cares for humanity, freedom, justice, progress, and to end the Israeli occupation of Palestine. On behalf of your brothers and sisters and comrades in the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unionists, Manuel Abdelal, June 20th, 2010.
That's a moving letter. That's beautiful. That's very gratifying. So in the future, is this a good precedent? And do you think there might be future actions in the same similar style?
Just came back from a week-long U.S. Social Forum held in Detroit. And every single person that I met have heard about the action in Oakland. Every person that they were very, very motivated and inspired by this action and really, really creating a ripple effect. Whether this is going to be repeated or not, people are talking about doing similar actions, not only here, but also around the world, because people take that courageous actions into account and wanted to do something similar. And we will not forget that Nelson Mandela, the former president of South Africa and the leader against the apartheid of regime of South Africa, has really recognized the work that workers done in Oakland in 1984 and mentioned the fact that that was the spark that has started more actions of that sort to engage in boycott, sanction, and divestment against South Africa. The U.S. Social Forum has really endorsed a call for boycott, sanction, and divestment against the state of Israel, which is, I think, this is a very significant step in the right direction.
Manal del Herzallah is a union organizer in the San Francisco Bay Area and a coordinating committee member of the USPCN, a grassroots organization that brings together Palestinian community around common goals and actions. To learn more, please visit thepalestinianconference.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Following the successful actions of ILWU, which prevented the unloading of an Israeli ship at the port of Oakland for the entire duration of two consecutive shifts, the Swedish Dock Workers Union launched a week-long boycott of cargo to and from Israel. On Wednesday of last week, about 1,500 members of the Swedish Dock Workers Union began their boycott across the country's ports, which handle more than 95% of Sweden's foreign trade. Swedish Dock Workers Union spokesperson Eric Helgeson spoke with Khalil from Gothenburg in Sweden.
Eric Helgeson, Swedish workers have launched a week-long boycott of cargo to and from Israel to protest against the raid on Gaza-bound aid flotilla that killed 9 people last month. About 1,500 members of the Swedish Dock Workers Union began the boycott on Wednesday across the country's ports, which handle more than 95% of Sweden's foreign trade. Describe this action a little bit. What happened exactly?
Well, it's been unlike other strike action and stuff we've seen the last year. This was a very calm action. Things went very smoothly. What we did was we identified cargo going in and out of the ports, either bound for Israel or coming from Israel. This is what we've been doing since the blockade started. And right now in Gothenburg, for example, we've only found or identified, I think, about 500 tons of Israeli goods. But we think the main effect of the action is that the cargo has been delayed, either in the ports or in the factories and stuff like that around Sweden, or in the other ports where they are coming from, in Germany and Belgium.
Tell us a little bit about what motivated you and your members, your union, to take such an action. And when did this solidarity movement begin in Sweden?
I think there's always been like a movement for the rights of Palestinians and so on, at least for some 40 years or so. But this question about the Israeli blockade of Gaza has been a topic for the Dock Workers Union since the Swedish Ship to Gaza organization was founded. I think it was 1.5 years ago. So we were involved in discussing ships leaving from Sweden to Gaza, how we would go about that practically, and how we would recruit volunteers to load the ships free of charge and so on. So we were involved long before the Israeli attack on the flotilla.
That's how you were able to take action so rapidly.
Yeah. The last discussion started before the flotilla was attacked because we had a lot of contact with our Greek dock worker comrades in the port of Piraeus in Greece, who loaded the ship there. And after the attack and 9 people were killed, we immediately discussed it again in the central committee of the union. And we decided to take action, I think, 4 days after the raid. In the beginning, we had a lot of problems with the employer or employers threatening our members with reduced pay and penalties and stuff like that. So we withdrew our first strike action and then launched a new one. So there was a bit of delay, but
who are the employers?
The employers are basically the ports of Sweden. I think there are about 30 ports on the east and west coasts of Sweden.
So these are publicly owned entities?
No, not all of them. The biggest port, the port of Gothenburg, which is the biggest one in the Nordic countries, is state-owned. But some of them are private enterprises and some of them are state-owned or shared owner interest between the state or the city and private enterprises.
And how did your union, your special central committee, come to this decision? Does it pretty much reflect the general opinion of the members, or is that just a select group of people?
Yeah, I would say it reflects the general reaction amongst Swedes, mm-hmm. because I think there was, it's not specific for the dock workers, but for very broad worker groups in Sweden, that we reacted in the same way as others and thought we have to do something. especially for the civilian population in Gaza. So, and I think the decision was made by the Central Committee, but then the reactions among the membership was very positive and has been all the way.
Another thing that intrigues me is, as you may be aware, in this country, United States of America, where there is a lot of freedom, there's also a lot of censorship and a lot of brainwashing. The general population is truly kept in the dark when it comes to many issues. We have a very corporate, rather racist, pro-colonialist mainstream media, which manages to really keep the people ignorant. And that seems to be true for a lot of the major European countries. How is it different in Sweden? Where does that awareness of the Palestinian issue come from? I mean, do you guys have a more independent media that's not too biased?
No, I can't compare very much, but we have the same problems with the media as every other westernized country or whatever you call it. That is not the big thing. The big thing is that there have been for at least 30 or 40 years now, like a big movement here, and people working very hard to get the message out about the Palestinians, their situation, what is going on, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, the effects of Gaza blockade and so on. It's not spread by the media primarily. A lot of work done, not by dock workers, I'm not taking credit for it, but a lot of like rank and file activists keeping the information flowing to other people, and people, if you keep that up long enough and people trust the source, trust you, then there will be like an awareness, and that will affect also the media. Like people wouldn't buy papers saying the same things that perhaps they say in American papers. Some of them. I read American papers sometimes, and I think people know a lot more about the world, and particularly about Israel and Palestine in Sweden, than the average American does. And that promotes a better quality of the media coverage as well.
Do you think some of the credit could go also to the Norwegians, who have been very visible and active on this issue?
If a government or a trade union or whatever makes a clear statement that is unexpected and goes further than anyone has done before, then you set a new standard. And Norway has been quite outspoken about Israeli crimes, and I think that affects the society in Norway and also in the Scandinavian countries. So maybe you can speak in another way, just because there's an example put forward by the Norwegian government, for example. I haven't seen them very much since the flotilla raid. I don't know if they've been very active or outspoken, but
they've been consistently in the forefront as far as Europe is concerned.
Okay.
When it comes to the BDS movement, boycott, sanctions,
yeah,
and divestment. So they've been quite impressive. And I was wondering whether your movement is in touch and coordinating with any other movements in Sweden or other countries in Europe, or are you guys pretty spontaneous and insulated?
Every time we do something like this for our own working conditions or concerning the civilian population in Gaza, we have to think at least quite a few times before we take action, because it can cost us very much. So it's not a spontaneous thing. We have help, of course. We use every resource that we have to make the blockade action efficient. Because of that, of course, we are in contact with, for example, BDS groups and pro-Palestinian groups and so on, just to get help with this project. But the main contact of the Swedish Dock Workers Union is with other dock workers around Europe and internationally.
I'm sure you're aware then that a similar, if more modest, action was taken right here in Oakland, California.
I know.
And that sort of action costs regular workers dearly. I mean, they have to surrender some of their wages. But
yeah,
you said that in your case, you managed this time to not lose too much in terms of compensation.
Yeah, I would say that's also due to the public pressure. Like, the public support that we had made it very hard for the employers to attack us. So instead, they took a passive stance. They haven't helped us, but they've been neutral. When they're neutral, the blockade is a quite easy thing to handle.
And why are the authorities, employers, against such a movement? Is it purely business related?
I know that we have the support of bosses and even higher ranking bosses. The support for the Palestinian civilians, I would say, in Gaza is very spread. It's not only a working class thing. It also includes the middle class and the richer bastards.
That's very encouraging. It's so rare to hear of a Western nation as Sweden where this is the case, because as we were saying earlier, all the major economies of this world are completely stuck in a pro-Israel, pro-colonialist stance because of the economic interests and the politics. But it's very nice to hear that at least Sweden seems to escape that. How is Zionist pressure in Sweden? Is it pretty moderate, pretty weak when you compare it to the surrounding countries?
It's not very different from other Northern European countries, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Germany, of course, is a bit different. They have a history, a tragic history, which I think affects them to be very, very cautious about what they say about Israel, and that's understandable, even though it's not fair to the Palestinians. But I think there are strong pro-Israeli groups here, too, but they have very, very little public support. I'm not saying that people are very active, that the average Swede is very active in his support for the Palestinian cause or for the Palestinian people, but we have a big understanding here. And the Zionist group, they react the same way as pro-Israeli groups have done everywhere. They just turn a blind eye to everything that Israel does and goes back to what they think is the basics, that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and it has a tragic history, and so on. We have received quite a few threats since we did this, some kind of campaign against us too, including, I wouldn't say threatening, but very disturbing calls from a lot of people, labeling us anti-Semites and
the usual, Israel, you're automatically an anti-Semite. You mentioned earlier how the press, unfortunately, is not all that different from the press in this country or other major European countries. How did the Swedish newspapers' controversy over Israel's traffic of Palestinian body parts affect Swedish public opinion?
Not very much, I think.
Yeah.
That was a discussion amongst media people and the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Like people don't react very much to it. And then after the facts were presented about this, that not in every aspect, but supported some of claims presented in the article, it changed the debate some.
So there was no public outcry against the pressure coming from Israel to
Yeah. That was, of course, no one defended that. That was like the most clumsy thing that Israel could do, try to censor our press. We don't like that. Not from Iran and not from Israel.
Not from anybody.
No.
I'm curious about something that may be indirectly related, and that's the state of Islamophobia, which has affected a lot of the major European countries, and even some of the smaller ones like Holland, Denmark. How is that, if at all, affecting Sweden? And if it is affecting Sweden, if the Swedes are also worried about the invading Islamic hordes, how does that factor into the Palestinian question, or are those two completely separate?
We have the same problems as the rest of the Western world, so to speak. So when racism like Islamophobia rises in Denmark and France and Holland and stuff like that, it raises here too. So we have that problem. We have racist parties trying to get into parliament, and they're not successful yet, but the numbers are worrying. So they might get in by the next election. We haven't yet let that affect the debate too much, but you could see in the media coverage of what happened to the Turkish boat, for example. Also in Sweden, there's like a big acceptance of the things presented by the Israeli Defense Force. Like, there were Islamists on board, and Islamists act like this and this, and they want to become martyrs, and I think the media is affected in the way that it very quickly adopts stereotypes of Muslims, while it doesn't adopt stereotypes of Jews or Christians or Hindus or something like that as quickly. There are stereotypes of every religion or ethnic group, but the Muslims are more affected, I would say. But the point is that in Sweden, I don't have the feeling that it affects the debate about Palestine and Israel very much. Because since we have a tradition of this question, since we have an awareness of this question, I think people in Palestine are regarded as humans also. Even people who are very skeptical of Muslims, I wouldn't say there are very many, but there are people who are very skeptical about Muslims and the religion, but they still don't accept the Palestinians being treated like animals. Israel is crossing the line, even for some of the Islamophobic people living here.
You mentioned also that this was not a one-time action, that you guys had tried at least one previously. Are you planning anything in the future, since the blockade has not been resolved, has not been stopped, the blockade of Gaza? Is your union talking about any potential further steps?
We haven't ruled out any alternative, but we will keep discussing this issue and what could be done with our colleagues around the world, including the ILWU and the French Dock Workers Union and so on. All of them. We will try to be a part of a discussion of what we could do to help the civilian population in Gaza. And we will also, in the future, contribute to ships leaving Sweden for Gaza. And I think there will be a few, at least, in the coming fall. So we will handle them free of charge, of course, and we will try to influence the employers not to charge the organizations anything. So that is what I can say we're definitely going to do. If we're going to take action like this by ourselves again, I don't know.
It seems that you're less and less by yourselves, you know, the more and more people across the world. So that's the encouraging news as well.
I think what I would dream of, if I'm allowed to do that, would be a coordinated action. And a coordinated action saying, no, we will not tolerate this anymore. Like 1.5 million people are suffering, and you can't treat people this way, even if the Hamas is the spawn of Satan or whatever you call them.
And to ask maybe my last question, I would like to know maybe a little bit more about the BDS movement in Sweden, since we're not in touch here, and our media here in the U.S. is very, very good about avoiding any mention of the BDS movement. Tell us a little bit about what other sectors of Swedish society have been active.
The pro-Palestinian movement, or the movement for Palestinian rights in Sweden, is very broad. The Swedish church, for example, is very, very critical of Israel's actions, not only in Gaza, but also on the West Bank. Many of the big Swedish trade unions have denounced the attack on the flotilla and have been very outspoken about the Israeli blockade on Gaza and the occupation of the West Bank.
Erik Helgesen is a spokesperson with the Swedish Dock Workers Union. He spoke with Khalil Bendib. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We'll be right back. want to learn more about this week's program, please visit us at vomena.org/blog. And while you're there, leave us a comment or any of your program ideas. We love to hear from you. Kiosk is one of the few Iranian underground bands which have gained wide popularity in the Iranian diaspora by fusing rock, jazz, and blues melodies with politically and emotionally charged lyrics. Kiosk fans will have the opportunity to see them perform live in concert this coming Sunday at Yoshi's Jazz Club in San Francisco. The band's founder and lead singer, Arash Sobhani, took time off from his busy schedule to talk to me about his artistic journey from Iran to the Bay Area.
It was a side project from all the other music projects we're doing inside Iran. And you may know, getting permission to publish an album or have concerts is very cumbersome and almost impossible process in Iran. And they basically don't like alternative rock music or anything that sounds Western. So we started Kiosk as a side project to the other music projects we were doing, which would get permission or which would be accepted by the government to, you know, have performance. And this Kiosk was like a little hobby of ours.
چاقه دست بخت عالی جهیزی کامل.
Your band is considered part of the growing underground music scene movement in Iran. What are the main characteristics of the underground music in Iran, and when did this underground music scene start to take form?
The whole life in Iran is kind of underground. Relationships, the music is part of that too. If you want to meet somebody, you have to be underground. If you want to watch a film, it's underground. It's probably not shown in cinemas. Or if you want to hang out with your friends, have alcohol, whatever, you know, you name it, it's all underground. So music wasn't any different from other aspects of life, but it started to, as albums, projects that were defined by musicians, I would say it's been around for more than 15 years. And eventually they started to get out of Iran and get onto iTunes, the breakthrough in the internet and using iTunes and other means of communication. And if music from Iran got, it was able to attract more listeners than yeah, what you have today.
In the beginning, in the 90s, it had more rock, blues, jazz sounds, but now it's going more towards hip-hop.
That is very true, and I think, you know, it's much easier to record a hip-hop album since the underground music cannot generate money because of the copyright issues, because the government doesn't allow this music to be published and sold in stores. The musicians cannot perform. There's no way to generate money from this music. So the bands end up not being able to produce more than one or two albums, while a hip-hop musician, he doesn't need a band. He doesn't need a big band. He doesn't need all the recording equipment and everything. He can use it with samplings and, you know, the other DJ techniques that they have. They can easily produce an album, and it's really, really going to cost a lot less than a rock or jazz album.
تکشان راه شیری زندگی یا کسیری مرخصی بی حقوقی طول درمانی بده.
The main thing that the government in Iran is really sensitive about is the lyrics. They do not want any kind of lyrics that would in any way criticize their policies, criticize the situation in Iran, or say anything negative. And they have other, you know, criteria for not allowing music to be published, of course. But this is the main reason, and they don't want anybody that they don't have control over to start, you know, getting tension and have a face or do a concert. I think underground movement was a social phenomenon. It, you know, it was a byproduct of all the social injustice we were witnessing in Iran, and that's where the music came from, very much similar to what happened in the 80s in Russia and the, you know, Eastern Europe. So in that sense, as a social phenomenon, it's been received really well outside of Iran, and it's been doing a great job in supporting the movement. Where it goes from here is really important, and how the artists involved in this movement can keep the art, artistic side of it, and still be the voice of the movement and, you know, the voice of the generation.
شبانه گزارش روز ایدان از عشق ایدان از عشق رفت سیام ایدان از عشق ایدان از عشق رفت سیام یکی تشنه یه قطره یکی کنار دریاست یکی صد ساله نشسته در انتظار فرس یکی در داد میزنه سیاست نیست یکی صدای راستی ولی حقیقتش در رو ایدان از عشق ایدان از عشق
Since the last year's protest, thousands of political activists, journalists, organizers have left Iran. Has it been also true for artists? Has there been sort of a mass exodus of young alternative musicians and artists leaving Iran?
Oh, yes. Oh, a lot of friends, a lot of musicians who are really hopeful that they can someday, you know, change the government's opinion on this kind of music and perform inside Iran. They decided that there's no way that things are going to get better, and they left Iran. And they're now, you know, if they could make it to the U.S., Canada, or Europe, they did. And a lot of them are in other countries, like Armenia, Malaysia, you know. A very good friend of mine with a very good underground band. The band that was working in the universities a lot just left Iran and arrived here 2 days ago. And I know many, many more.
اگه بحران آب بود هجرت سراب بود تقصیر من بود اگه زمستون و سرده تابستون و گرمه تقصیر من بود اگه جاده ها باریکن کنوچه ها تاریکن تقصیر من بود تقصیر من بود تقصیر من
So, since you knew that your songs and your music would never be performed in public in Iran, you would not get permission to produce your CDs and sell them, where did you want to go with your music in the beginning?
I think it was just more of a, like a diary. It was something that you would do to release yourself. It was, you know, the feelings, the agony you had inside of you, and you had to kind of express it in a way. And recording them for me and for our band was just for ourselves. We were even scared that other people hear it and, you know, we get in trouble. And I think that was the case with the other, you know, a lot of other musicians, and of course with writers and painters.
Your music is a combination of rock, blues, and jazz. So where did you get your inspiration to mix all these different genres with Persian lyrics and create your music?
Well, I think Bob Dylan has been an influence to us, and he's, you know, he's amazing and been influenced by his work and his lyrics and everything. We started writing songs in that style because that was a style we grew up listening to and we liked, and Dire Straits and other bands as well.
اطلاف جوراسی پاها مشغول استثمار با نظارت همه چه پیدن تقیقا حساسیت به نور و افتاد کوردلی مزمن انجمار مغزی عوارز عصر یخ بلا
It's been a long journey, and we've struggled to kind of define some our own sound that's more unique and more kiosk and, you know, relates more to our situation rather than Dire Straits or Bob Dylan or others. But they have been a great influence on us. They've taught us how it's really done, how you can say such meaningful words in such a short time with such simple songs. You know, when the underground movement started in Iran, I was skeptical that this can even happen. A lot of playing with the idea of incorporating Farsi into rock music, and I was, you know, against it. At the beginning, I thought it's not doable. Farsi has its own melody as a language, and rock music requires a different kind of language to sit well on it. But as I started to play with it, and, you know, especially with blues forms and more freestyle like jazz, I realized that there are some ways that we can do this, and we've been working on that, and it's been really, really interesting experience for me.
Your earlier songs actually were about living in Iran. You sang about the war, about the daily life in Tehran, about the social and political control and censorship under this theocratic regime. And you've been out of Iran, you've been performing and continuing your work since 2006 outside Iran. So where do you get your inspirations from now?
I think for me and for the rest of the band, the subject hasn't changed. The subject for all of our lyrics and our work is how an Iranian sees what's going on around him. When I was in Iran, I was talking about an Iranian and how he sees what is going on around him in Tehran. But now, as an Iranian, I see what's going on around me outside of Iran. But still, I'm looking towards Iran, so I'm following the news inside of Iran. I'm constantly in contact with, you know, what's going on back home and, you know, with my friends and everything. So I'm still looking at the same subject, but from a distance and from an angle. But the subject hasn't changed. After the elections in Iran last year, the events were happening so fast and it was so immense that I couldn't just keep up with it. I started blogging and I started writing, you know, articles, because I couldn't write songs anymore, you know. Eventually I went back to my, you know, previous method and started scribbling down little, you know, pieces from here and there, the news, what I felt, what I saw, and then started to stitch them together and want, you know, at the right moment and create new songs. So
how do you see your evolution as an artist in the past few years?
I think in terms of form, I've become more polished or refined, maybe more conservative.
In what sense?
In terms of form, you know, the artistic form, you know. I was probably more daring, at the same time more brutal before, but now I care a lot more about the... I'm more careful when I choose a word and how it sounds and what it really means, you know, as opposed to before I was applying more of a conversation way of writing poems. I see that big change in me, and the other changes have been in the music, of course. You know. From certain points, I started to think probably sticking to these standard structures of jazz and blues are not doing it for us. Maybe we should, you know, explore more areas. And I was introduced to gypsy music, and I tried to see if I can incorporate that into our music, and I found a lot of similarities with Eastern European music and Northern Iran, especially Azeri music. And we started experimenting other instruments as well. You know, we got our keyboard player to play accordion. We got a violin player to play with us. So the whole sound kind of became more authentic, more acoustic. We have always, you know, we collaborated with a lot of different artists, and Iranian and non-Iranian. In our second album, we also had an American violinist player did an amazing job on our album. But in this upcoming show, in our upcoming album, we have three guest musicians, non-Iranians, and they're great jazz musicians, and it's an honor for us to play with them. Yeah.
you're going to be playing at Yoshi's Jazz Club in San Francisco. You're going to be performing two shows on July 4th at 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. And your new album is going to be recorded live at Yoshi's that night. So how are you managing that logistically? And this is the first time you're doing this.
Correct. I believe after the revolution in Iran in 1979, no band, you know, no rock band has ever had the chance to record a live album. And since we've been doing this concert and outside of Iran for a few years, we thought we'd be ready to do this, and we can introduce our music this way better to non-Iranian audience. And this is a chance that we should take advantage of. Of course, Yushi is a very exciting place, and we're really happy that we can play there now. We're going to do a lot of, you know, new arrangements of the old songs and a lot of new songs, but mostly we're going to keep it jazzy, and I think we're all very excited for it.
So what is one of your own favorite songs, and if you can tell us what it is about?
One of my all-time favorites is Tarone from our first album. The reason I like it is because the recording is very brutal and underground, minimum equipment and everything.
اون همه ترانه شعر عاشقانه دیدی همش حرف بود و حرف.
The song is a love song, basically talking about a separation, how bitter it can be, but in a very ordinary way that someone speaks in Tehran. And I like the melody. I think it's the kind of has this bit of what we're going to be playing at Yoshi.
Kiosk will be performing live at Yoshi's in San Francisco on Sunday, July 4th at 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. For more information, visit yoshis.com.
You can always visit us at vomena.org/blog. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Up next, the community calendar.
گفتی با تو بوده صحبت تو همیشه حالا میگی آقابت نداره تقصیر من نیست کار روزه داره روزای آفتابی شمای مهتابی مثل نقشه روی آبم نمیمونه مناری های من گرفتار غفلت اگه باشه میگه آبازی نمیخونه حالا میخوای جداشی تو آسمون نهاشی دلم مال تو روحم مال تو هر جای دنیا که باشی
Khaliq, a leading member of the Labour Party of Pakistan, will be giving a talk on the political and economic crisis in Pakistan as well as the impact of U.S. occupation in that country.
This talk will take place at the opening session of the West Coast Socialism Conference on Thursday, July 1st at 7 p.m. at the Oakland Marriott located at 1001 Broadway in Oakland. For more information, you may call 773-583-7884. Also part of this weekend's West Coast Socialism Conference, Breaking the Siege on Gaza, Taking a Stand Against Israeli Apartheid, will be a panel discussion with guest speakers Paul Larudi, a Bay Area-based activist who took part in the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, Dr. Jess Benham of Al-Auda, Wael El-Asadi, co-founder of a Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights at Portland State University, and Sherry Wolf, leading member of the International Socialist Organization. This panel discussion will be on Friday, July 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Oakland Marriott, located at 100 Broadway in Oakland. For more information, you may call 773-583-7884.
There will be a demonstration during Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit and meeting with President Obama in Washington, D.C. The gathering will take place on Tuesday, July 6th at 4:30 p.m. in front of the Israeli consulate located at 456 Montgomery Street in San Francisco. For more information, call the Answer Coalition at 415-821-6545. This week, this has been Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We look forward to your comments and suggestions. You may reach us by email at vomekpfa@yahoo.com or by phone at 510-848-6767, extension 632.
You can download the podcast of our program on the archives page of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa at kpfa.org. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Join us again next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. And please stay tuned for Debt to the World coming up next.
KPFA's Evening with Christopher Hitchens, scheduled for July 15th, is canceled. He will not be coming to the West Coast this summer, we're told. If you have already bought tickets, for a full refund, please contact either the independent bookstore that sold them to you or contact brownpapertickets.com. Their phone number, 800-838-3006. That's brownpapertickets.com, 800-838-3006. That is 800-838-3006 for brownpapertickets.com. And here's wishing the Hitch a prompt and full recovery.
And you are tuned to KPFA or KPFB.